From the campus of Yale University, this is Business Talk with Jim Campbell, nationally syndicated across the country on the Biz Talk Radio Network and coming to you from our flagship stations, Yale Radio WYBC and 1490 AM WGCH Greenwich. All talk and all business, 60 minutes of radio with leading figures from the world of business along with the business of politics and sports. The inside story of working with Donald Trump from a former Trump Organization senior executive. This is Business Talk with Jim Campbell. George Sorio was executive vice president, counsel to the Trump Organization for over 12 years, working directly alongside Donald Trump until his inauguration as 45th president. He then became EVP and chief compliance counsel to the Trump Organization, reporting directly to Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump. Co-author Damian Bates worked as a journalist for 30 years in the UK, and he's known Trump for over a decade. Their book, The Real Deal, My Decade Fighting Battles and Winning Wars with Trump. Welcome, George. How are you?
I'm good, Jim. Thank you very much for having me on.
It's good to have you. We've had some tough shows on Trump, so we like to consider ourselves from the radical center and fair and balanced. So it's good to have a guy who's been right at Trump's side for so long. Tell us exactly what your role was, and then what you ended up after the compliance pressures on the organization.
Well, I came into the company, Jim, initially as a lawyer. After working there for just 3 or 4 months, I was called into Mr. Trump's office at the time, and he said to me, "Look, we just acquired 1,500 acres of land in the northeast of Scotland. We're going to build a golf course. We're going to build a hotel. We're going to build some homes. Your mother's Scottish. My mother's Scottish. You've got family over there. I'm going to put you in charge. This is going to be great." So I morphed out of the legal department and got heavily involved in real estate development. And that's really where I spent the thrust of my career there, developing hotels, developing golf courses. I did a lot of work in Scotland, in Aberdeen, in Turnberry, and I was also very involved with our project in Ireland, at Trump Dún Beag. Then, after the election, I was made chief compliance counsel. I was responsible for implementing a company-wide compliance program, really designed to keep the executive office of the president completely separate from the company. So I was the one that was dealing with conflicts of interests, emoluments, and essentially sparring with Congress for the past 2 years. So, you know, over 12 years, I had a very, I wore many different hats. I had a very varied series of roles, but all of them were interesting.
And you didn't even play golf, right?
You know, that's the funny thing. When he called me into the office that day, that was actually my first response was A, you know, I've never really done development, and B, I don't even know. I mean, I've held a golf course, a golf club once or twice in my life. I didn't know anything about the game. And, you know, he said, "Good, that's even better. You know, I can teach you, and at least I don't have to worry about you being over there just playing golf."
You know, before we jump into where I want to go, you mentioned emoluments. Is there anything to this, the old post office building that they renovated, which is beautiful looking, and emoluments?
You know, every day I'm somewhat frustrated when I turn on the TV and there's some legal expert, somebody from Harvard who's, you know, professing to be an expert on these emoluments clause, and there really isn't a clear definition of what that term even means. It's a word that appears twice in the U.S. Constitution. Unlike many legal issues, let's say if we had a tax problem, I'd be able to go and look at the IRS code. I could look at regulations. I could look at advisory opinions. I could look at case law. But we haven't really had any of that on what constitutes an emolument. Now, anyone who knows anything about the law realizes that you don't just pick up the Constitution and read it and say, okay, this is what that means. So we took a position that patronage at our hotels, which are just essentially regular old market arm's-length transactions people are paying for a service, don't constitute emoluments. And we defended our position. We had a whole panel of legal experts put together a white paper that set forth our rationale, and then we applied that rationale consistently over the past couple of years. So until we have some clear definition, and I think, as you may know, Jim, there are currently two lawsuits working their way through the federal system. Until we get some guidance and some clear definitions on what an emolument is, you know, there's a difference of legal opinions, and, you know, we think we're right, and we endeavored to really do the right thing, and again, we were consistent about how we applied it. So until someone really provides some clear definition, I mean, we're just as right as anybody else.
Okay, let's jump in, because I know people will be interested in this. What are the biggest misperceptions about DJT, as you call him, Mr. Trump?
Well, I think the biggest one, and, you know, I talk about it quite a lot, because I think there's a perception out there that he's a person that doesn't listen, he's a person that steamrolls over people's opinions, he's a person that does whatever he wants. And I really found that the exact opposite of that was true. And it brings me back to a day where we had a very difficult afternoon on a construction site. There were a number of issues that we walked through and resolved. And when it was finally over with, it was just me and him, and we were chatting. And he said to me, you know, George, people always ask me, how did I succeed? How did I do so well in life? And I say, it was very easy. I just look around, I listen to people, I talk to people, I get information, and then I just give them what they want. I listen to people, and I give them what they want. And in all my years working with him, I really found that that's how he operated. I mean, just to give you a real simple example, if we were trying to decide, you know, on what type of rug to use at a property or in a ballroom, and we had three or four different options, he would frequently leave the samples on his desk and poll every single person that came into the room. These might be, some might be executives, lawyers, bankers, celebrities. Anyone coming into his office would get asked, which one do you like? Now, look, ultimately he would make his own decision, but I think that misperception that he doesn't listen to people is so wrong, because I think that's really the essence of him. He does listen to people. And look how he applied that knowledge to the 2016 election. I mean, I can remember, as I'm sure you can, Jim, the night before the election, looking at my screen and seeing there's no path to victory. Trump was down 8 to 10 points in every poll. There was no chance he could win. Every pundit in the world had discounted what he was doing from day one.
Mm-hmm.
But he knew something. He had tapped into something, and I think it comes from the fact that he went all over the country, he talked to people, and he listened. And look, ultimately, he was right.
You know, it's funny, too. To me, Washington missed the complete disenchantment of the whole middle class group in there that hadn't had a raise in 20 years, and he tapped into that. Your book makes that point throughout, that he's very – it's almost like he's just, his hand is on the pulse of the customer at all time. Why does he only show his hard side, thin-skinned? You talk about he's soft-spoken behind the scenes. Why do we only see one side of him?
Well, I think that's it's a difficult question to answer. Certainly anyone who spends, you know, even a small amount of time with him personally does see that side. And I think I'm always, it's always interesting for me when I used to bring somebody from outside of the office in to meet with him for the first time, because there'd be, you know, in many instances, people would be a little bit nervous, but he's very charming. He has an old world charm about him. I remember the first time I went to his office, you know, he got up from behind his desk. He came and met me at the door, shook my hand. You know, a lot of that personal touch, just people, it just doesn't exist anymore. But it really, it lives with him. I don't know why, you know, his public persona is portrayed very differently. I think part of it is, I think he enjoys being somewhat unpredictable, and he uses that to his advantage. So people really don't know what they're getting, and I don't think that's a bad thing for a leader, certainly not the President of the United States. During, you know, let's face it, Jim, these are very dangerous times.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he uses that, you know, unpredictable factor to his advantage. He certainly used it a lot in business. And I think you see him doing the exact same thing in politics.
All right, we're under a minute. and I don't know if you can do this, but the role of Melania, his family, how important they are, whatever we don't know.
They're first of all, Melania is really a delightful person, and I got to know her well, and I know her family well. You know, it pains me that she's maligned by the mainstream media. But I certainly, as a couple, they're very tight. I saw it over and over again where he really relied on her. He listened to her. He valued her opinion. You know, but perhaps she's a little less of a public performer than her husband.
Next segment, we'll talk about building a golf course against all odds in Scotland and more on the inside look at Mr. Trump. We're back with former Trump Executive Vice President George Sorio. If I'm putting Trump on the couch for a second, the influence of his dad, I know he has no drinking, no drugs issue because of his brother dying prematurely, and I was asking about that hard side. Is dad speaking through him, you know, never let down, win at all costs?
Well, I never had the pleasure of meeting his father, but I could certainly say that, you know, the president would frequently talk about his father. He would frequently tell us stories about how sharp his father was, how tough his father was, how precise his father was. I mean, one of the things that was drilled into my head from day one was, you know, he would tell me, look, you really have to know, you have to know everything that's going on about any project you're working on. You have to know what we're spending, where the money is going, why we're doing things this way. You know, you really have to be on top of things. And that's, you know, that was very valuable advice, because if you've ever been involved in development, as they say, you really have to be there. You've got to be on top of it. And he was certainly very involved in things himself, very detailed oriented. And I think these are traits that he definitely learned from his father, because in working in the office with people who had been there for a long time that did work with his father, you know, there was kind of this extreme level of respect. And I think his father brought a certain discipline to business that, you know, really was picked up by his son.
Let me ask you now, you talk in the book that a lot of folks there have been employed in the Trump Organization for some cases decades, but a long time. In the White House, he seems to have just constant turnover. Has he had trouble building the same level of trust that he's used to in the Trump Organization, or what's behind that?
Well, I think you're definitely right, Jim, in the organization. You know, people like me were not, you know, aberrations. I was there for almost 13 years. There are plenty of people that have been in the company for, you know, that long or longer. I mean, we have people that have been in the company for 40 years. I think things are somewhat different in the White House. It's a different dynamic. It's a very stressful environment. I think it is taking a little bit of time to really put a team together that understands how he works. I mean, let's face it, Jim. He is a very different, unconventional, you know, politician. And I feel, you know, as a person that worked with him for so long on the business side, I mean, I feel strange even referring to him as a politician, but I mean, he has become a politician. But he has a very different side, and I think if you look at his approach to running the country, he does run it like a business. The Trump I know his logic. You know, frequently when you have an adversary in business, you may not, you know, have all the solutions, but getting together, meeting, you know, putting a face to the voice, that can go a long way towards breaking down a problem. And you can remember when Obama left the White House, President Obama said to incoming President Trump, your biggest problem is going to be in the Korean Peninsula.
Yeah.
And look, is it resolved? No. Do we have a long way to go? Yes, perhaps. But things are ratcheted down. People are talking. And again, today, I think if he goes to the DMZ and even just shakes his hand, it's another step towards a solution that's in the best interests of the United States.
Yeah, it is pretty unbelievable. And even his aides were taken by surprise that he's just going to do this. It is interesting. You're critical a little bit about his use of Twitter, right? You think that he's just inciting, people that shouldn't be even get credit for being critics, right?
Well, it was, look, Jim, people have to be who they are. And I think the saying, you have to let Trump be Trump, is very true. Does he say and put things out on Twitter that perhaps you and I might not? Sure. But look, it's his style. And yes, there were many instances where, we would have an adversary and the adversary would be making a lot of noise. And, my preferred method would be avoidance and just walk away, because when you engage somebody like that, you frequently throw fuel on the fire and you create a much bigger problem. But look, his style is to counterpunch, engage, and fight. And at the end of the day, people have to be comfortable in their own skin, and that's just who he is.
Do you think that it matters that he exaggerates, and he has for 40 years, his net worth, sometimes big, sometimes, do you think that matters?
I don't think it matters. I mean, again, in his line of business and what he does, he sells, he spins the positive. I don't really think it. I don't know what he's worth, and I don't think it really matters.
Now, let's go to the golf course here, because this story is really unbelievable, right? I mean, there was almost no chance that this was going to go through. Plus, nothing but bureaucracy over there, right? They didn't have really the vision to do this. So tell us how you guys got it through. And even when you took over the program, the project wasn't being well run, right?
Yeah, it was a difficult, situation. And, Jim, I am half Scottish, so I say this with all love and deference. It's a different, difficult climate to work in, and especially when you're talking about the northeast of Scotland, and then you have the big brash Americans coming in, telling the Scots, we're going to build the world's greatest golf course. there's a lot of golf courses that are pretty great in Scotland. But, I think a lot of the commotion, a lot of the, perception that this was a project that the locals fought, I don't think that's accurate. I spent a long time there, and I really found that the overwhelming majority of the locals embraced the project. They understood it. They recognized that the area had been so dependent on oil and gas.
Yeah.
And there was a need to diversify, and, tourism was something that they had taken seriously. There are a number of great horses in the area. So in actuality, we were embraced by the majority of the locals. Certainly the business community was behind us. At the time, the government was behind us. So, initially we stumbled. We had a bad hearing. The threshold decision from the planning authority was to approve the project. And then because of the scale of it, we had to appear in front of another wider committee that ended up rejecting the application. But it was, another thing people failed to report was the vote was 7-7. And the way the rules work in Scotland, the chair gets to cast another vote. So, he knocked it down. But, look, we regrouped. It was a difficult time for me personally. I mean, it wasn't an easy call to make back to New York, to tell Mr. Trump at the time that, hey, look, we just went down in court. Your dream project just went out the window. But, after a little bit of clearing the air and, passions, got thrown aside, we refocused. And, to answer your question, we fought like hell.
And I guess, impressively, Trump, after it was over, still had the long view. We'll talk about Trump in the White House. He'll finish up on Scotland. Back with George Soriel. The book is The Real Deal, Decade Fighting Battles and Winning Wars with Trump. He was side by side, so he's got kind of an inside view. I want to finish up on Scotland. It was fairly aspirational. I think there were going to be 500 houses or a 500-room hotel, etc. none of that stuff has happened yet. Is that still on the docket, or they
yeah,
just?
Yeah, well, we had so many battles over there, and then we got into this long, protracted litigation over the construction of an offshore wind facility. But we're back on track. We built and opened the golf course. It's doing fairly well. All the infrastructure is in place. We have a small hotel. We have a clubhouse. And we actually now have before the planning authority an application to build the first tranche of houses, 500 homes. We hope that will be heard sometime before the year's over. And, you know, if things go well at the beginning of next year, we'll be building homes there.
Who's running that project now?
Sarah Malone, the wife of Damian Bates, who is my co-author.
Right.
Sarah is one of our EVPs in Scotland, a great person, a tough person. She's been with us now for a decade,
uh-huh.
So she's in charge of operations in Aberdeen.
So are you still with the Trump organization?
No, I resigned. It feels strange me even saying that, but I left. My last day in the company was June 7th.
Wow, I see. So you're doing this as a consultant now, right, in other words?
Yeah, I don't know how involved I'm going to be with organization business. I really felt that I couldn't really promote my book while still in the position of chief compliance counsel. And I actually felt so strongly about the message behind my book that I thought it would be a lot more effective. It was more important for me to get out of the company, although I love the place, and do this. And I think going forward, I still have a very good relationship with the president. I actually saw him last week in Orlando. I see him fairly often. I don't think I will be a part of the campaign, but I will definitely support his efforts to be reelected. Don and Eric are two people that are like my brothers, essentially. It's kind of like we grew up together in the company. So I'm always going to remain very close to them.
Do you? Did they have any censorship, or did they want to see the book first? They tell you to take stuff
out? No, people, I was literally, the way the whole, I'd been thinking about writing a book for some time.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to see him one day. I'm sitting in the Oval Office, and we just were talking about different things. And he said to me, you know, these people come in here, they sit with me for half an hour, they go out, they write a book, they say they're, you know, that they're my biographer. So I kind of jumped in and said, well, you know, look, how about letting me write a book? And, you know, he looked at me for about 30 seconds and said, I think that's great. Go ahead, do it. And I did not, the copy that he ended up reading, and the copy that Eric and Don and everybody else is the same copy that you have. The only thing I did, there was no editing. I mean, I went back and I did some fact-checking because just to gather information for the book, I did a number of interviews, so I would always, you know, verify with the person that I interviewed, hey, look, is this actually what you said? But there was really no editing. They let me do my own thing, and I think that's a part of the whole appeal of the book.
Now you've been in the White House, the Oval Office. You've had dinner with him and everything. How's he faring stress-wise? Is he thriving on the job? Does he like it? What's your sense?
Jim, this is a guy that thrives under pressure. This is a person that really performs in the face of conflict. I mean, look, everybody's wired differently. Some people, you put them under pressure, they break. As the saying goes, other people, you put them under pressure and you create diamonds. He certainly is in that category. I think the more you throw at him, the better. Just by way of example, whenever we traveled with him, we always made sure that he had a full calendar because there's nothing worse than him with idle time. This is not a guy that sits around and does nothing. He always needs to be occupied. So I think he's in a place that he loves when he's challenged, when he's dealing with complex issues, when he's under fire. And I've never seen anyone thrive or anyone perform better under fire than him. So conflict is something that he doesn't run from it. He thrives on it.
Wow. So let's talk about this now. Michael Cohen called him a con, cheat, racist. He had been a fixer in a sense. I mean, some of the most trusted things from Stormy Daniels on out, this guy was involved in. You worked closely with him. What happened? Who is Michael Cohen?
Well, I think Michael Cohen's role in the company is often overstated. And in full disclosure, Michael was a good friend of mine. And it's a difficult subject, I think, not only for me, but for anybody in the company, because I'd be disingenuous if I didn't admit that, you know, people liked Michael.
Mm-hmm.
There was certain likable quality about him, but I think his role was overstated. He was never involved in the actual core of the business. I mean, what does the Trump Organization do?
Mm-hmm.
We're real estate developers. He never ran projects. He never closed a deal, to my knowledge. He never really had any meaningful licensing deals. You know, look, he did bits and pieces here and there. Quite frankly, even though he was my friend, I didn't really know what he was doing the majority of the time because he was not, you know, a person that was confident in his role there. Quite frankly, I think he spent the majority of his time doing his own work. He had a number of investment properties. He had a taxi cab medallion business.
Yeah.
But he was a bit of a colorful character. And, you know, as I said in the book, certainly if you need somebody to come into a room and knock some heads together, you know, Michael was pretty good at that. And, you know, look, in real estate development, sometimes things get rough. But his role was overstated. And I think ultimately, you know, why did Michael go to jail? He lied to Congress. He didn't pay his taxes, and he defrauded banks. I mean, those are all personal crimes. And I think, Jim, I have no doubt in my mind that, you know, I watched him very carefully when he was testifying.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw just moments of sadness. And I could, you know, sometimes you can see regret in somebody's eyes. And I don't have any doubt that, you know, look, I hope he comes out a better person. I hope he uses his 3 years productively. I wish his family the best. But I think he's going to come out and say, why did I do that?
The, you know, he used to say he'd take a bullet for Trump. And obviously the Trumps must have been very upset that he became disloyal. Did he want a job in the White House, which he's denied? Was there some motivation for this, or did he just wake up and felt like he'd, you know, that he'd been lying for Trump too long?
Well, I think the motivation, you know, A, was to get himself out of a bad situation, and it's common knowledge that his wife had co-signed a lot of those loans, so I think she was in jeopardy.
Yeah.
So, you know, to be fair to him, it's a difficult situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in my early days, I started out working as a county counsel, and I was often in situations where, you know, somebody was in a room and they were being told, look, you're going to go to jail for, you know, 50 years or you're going to cooperate. And time again, I've seen tough people, you know, fold in those circumstances. But, yeah, he did want a job in the White House. During the transition period, I wouldn't even say a day didn't go by. I don't think an hour went by where he didn't tell somebody that I want to be chief of staff.
Wow.
I want to be White House counsel. But, it, you know, to be fair to Michael, I mean, there were things that Michael was good at, but that was something that was, I think everyone would have agreed, was well over his head. He wasn't really qualified to do that. And, yes, I do think that he felt scorned when he didn't end up going to Washington. But, you know, look, I think ultimately that was the right decision.
And you never had any interest in going?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think if a situation like this presented itself to me, you know, 15, 20 years ago, I would have dove on it. But, you know, Jim, at 50, I have, you know, aging parents that spend most of their time in Florida. I've got young children. I was one of these guys that started late in life. You know, I've got a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old. Just uprooting my life and going to Washington just wasn't in the cards right now. But, you know, you can. I still support him in many other ways.
1 minute to go. We were talking off air that, you know, he has this way of being almost a blue-collar guy that can relate to people. I understand that at his club, you can actually just go sit at his table and have lunch with him, right?
That's 100% true. I mean, when you're once you get through that layer of security and you're inside, I mean, he's a social guy. Okay, he doesn't want a table in a back room or, you know, a private room. He wants to be right in the middle, talking to people. He even still to this day will get up, go from table to table, shake hands, take pictures. And that's not just at his clubs. I mean, you go to any restaurant with him, he doesn't want special treatment. He just wants to be with everybody else.
Final segment coming right up, the real deal. Final segment, George Soriel, 12-year senior executive working for Donald Trump. So you know the art of the deal, the real deal. In your book, you say you kind of have a sense of his next move. So I want to ask you, take some of these issues. We talked North Korea, but take tariffs now in China. You know, normally people would say that's the dumbest thing you can do to put tariffs on, but it looks to be very effective in terms of getting the Chinese to the table. Where would you see an end game, though? Because if it doesn't work, it's not good.
You know, look, I think I would, to answer that question, we got to really go back and see what's happened over the past several decades where,
yes,
you know, there have been tariffs, but it's all been one-sided. I mean, look, it's a difficult situation, and in full disclosure, there are certainly people that know a lot more about this sort of thing than me, but just looking at it as a layperson, nothing has been accomplished for decades. It's a fact that, you know, let's take intellectual property. They've been stealing our intellectual property for years.
Yes, $300 billion a year, it's been estimated, of on intellectual property alone of stealing.
Yeah, they've built their whole economy on, you know, the backs of our, you know, ingenuity and creativity, and we've done nothing about it. So I think sometimes you have to take a draconian measure to really make a point and at least wake up your adversary. Sometimes you got to hit him with a stick.
Yeah.
And I think, look, we're not there yet, but at least they're listening. There's some response. They seem to be agreeing on certain things. One of the things that I was actually speaking to the president over a lunch probably 5 or 6 months ago, and the subject of China came up, and he spoke very highly of Xi Jinping. And his exact words were, he's a very smart guy. We respect each other. We have tremendous respect for each other, mm-hmm. and we're going to work something out. So, look, you know, they're doing what they have to do. We're doing what we have to do. I think ultimately nobody's really benefiting from these tariffs, and I think after passing through some short-term suffering, I think we'll end at a better place. But really, what choice did the president have? How else could you resolve that problem?
No one else would have taken this risk, I don't think, a tariff. I hope the ending is good. Let me ask you about this. Now, he has his vision for deals. Do you buy into there may be this big Middle East deal that's sitting out there? And what do you know about Jared Kushner?
I mean, it's a really difficult situation, and it's actually one that I know well because in addition to having a Scottish mother, my father is a Coptic Orthodox Christian. We're Christians from Egypt.
Ah.
So I've spent a lot of time over there. You know, look, is it possible to have a solution? I think we have no choice but to answer yes, because we always have to strive towards peace. But it's a really complicated situation. And again, I have to give Jared credit. I mean, it's really Jared and Jason Greenblatt.
Mm-hmm.
Jason was our former general counsel who's now intimately involved in all these negotiations. But I have to give them credit for pushing the ball forward. I think some great things have been accomplished. I think moving the embassy was finally, you know, something that had been promised for a long time. And, hey, it was supposed to create chaos and there was going to be, you know, all sorts of problems. But I think that went relatively smooth. And look, people are talking. People are trying to work things out. There seems to be a degree of trust on the table. So, you know, look, are they going to pull it together and, you know, come out with some kind of ultimate solution that's going to result in peace in the area? I mean, I hope so, but it's a difficult task.
It's a difficult task. I've always felt that the key was to give the Palestinians economic incentive to do it, because right across that wall is one of the greatest growth engines in the world, Israel. Their own leaders are terrorists and steal all the money. But It hasn't gotten through thus far. Tell us, why is Trump so averse to releasing his taxes?
I don't know. I mean, you know, look, I think there's a legitimate cause for concern. I mean, any lawyer would say if you're being audited, there's no point in releasing your return. So that's a part of it. But I would answer the question as to why should he? Okay, there are rigorous laws in place that require certain financial disclosures for anybody running for president, and he has satisfied those, and he has continued to satisfy all the reporting requirements while he's been president. Why should he turn over his tax returns? He has a complicated business portfolio, and, yeah. You know, let's be honest, Jim. I mean, anybody, you know, you give your returns to five different experts, you know, everybody's going to have something to say about it, and yeah. I don't think any intelligent person would voluntarily open themselves up to that level of scrutiny. But I think he has made all the disclosures that are required, and I don't think the tax return thing, I think it's a waste of time, and it's just the Democrats throwing up smoke and trying to cast something negative because he's winning, because he's achieving, because he's doing well.
What do you think that he wants his legacy to be? I was surprised. Here he is, president. That Eric Trump in the book says that building is his thing and it's his legacy. What do you think it is overall?
I think it's a combination of, you know, he's had a very interesting life, Jim. I mean, there's not many people that he was successful in real estate, then he pivoted, he became very successful in media and TV, and then, at 70 years old, he was elected president. You know, that's a rare thing to have that level of success in so many different lines of, you know, business, so to speak. But so I think Eric is right. I think, look, Donald Trump was a great developer, but I think, you know, what he would want people to reflect is what I just pointed out. He was good at many things, and ultimately I think it's very important to him that history reflects or shows him to be a president that took the country out of a very dangerous place, because I think myself and millions of Americans felt that this country was on the wrong track. And I think he's done a tremendous job of righting the ship. I think we need to give him another term so he can complete that job. But I firmly believe that we were on the wrong path. We've had presidents in the past that I'm not even sure their primary focus was U.S. They were globalists. They were apologetic for some of the things that we had done in our past. That's not what I want in the Oval Office. I'm proud to be an American, Jim. This is a country, we have so much freedoms, okay? We're the envy of the world, and I think there's often a segment of the population that just doesn't realize that because they haven't been to places. They haven't been to the places like the Middle East where, you know, we couldn't even have a phone call like we're having now. We couldn't have a conversation like we're having now. America's a great country, and I love the fact that he's got our backs, and he has one sole focus, and that focus is what's best for this country.
Thanks to George Soriel. That book is The Real Deal, My Decade Fighting Battles and Winning Wars with Donald Trump. They were side by side for 12 years. This has been Business Talk with Jim Campbell. Thanks to George. Thanks to our national audience for listening. We'll see everybody on the next edition of Business Talk with Jim Campbell.